No Jumper, coolest podcast in the world. Today I'm here with a couple of guys who we're probably going to need some explaining for a pretty good percentage of our audience of who you guys are. So perhaps we could get some introductions first.
Sure. I'm Matt, and I'm one of the co-founders of The Hard Times. It's a satire website based in the underground music scene. So the easiest way to define it would be The Onion, but for punk kids.
Mm. And I am Bill, and I'm also the co-founder of the same exact website he just described. So,
liar.
Wait, easy, man. Come on. Why are you coming
this
at me
so quick?
This is my
assistant.
Oh, assistant.
Wow.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I like that.
That's
sorry.
Why I was late. I was parking the car.
Big homie him real quick.
Yeah.
Holy shit. So you now say the underground music scene. So you've kind of gotten away from it being like hardcore specific. I feel like in the early days it was more, because that's like where you guys are really specifically coming from, right?
Yeah, so that's where we came from. I played in a couple hardcore bands. I toured the U.S. a couple times in hardcore bands. Did like the DIY basement show thing for a long time, but The Hard Times has really branched out. Pretty much it started with Bill and I just kind of brainstorming ideas together, but now we have writers from all over the country and world contributing their own perspectives. So now we do a whole bunch of different types of music and culture at large.
Mm.
And a lot of times, like, we'll have people that get into the group that have no idea anything about hardcore or punk, and we're like, why did you apply to be with us? You
really?
Know, like,
should we call them out by name?
Yeah, let's go down the list.
But it's just such a bizarre like subculture. The older I get, the further that I get away from it, the mm-hmm. funnier or the weirder a lot of my childhood memories seem. And then I guess that's why I feel such an endeared sense towards the Hard Times, is just because it's very, very good at like pointing out how absurd many of the things that are considered normal in the hardcore scene or adjacent scenes are.
It's weird, man. I think in order to enjoy The Hard Times truly, you have to be just a little bit jaded.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's not hard to get jaded in the hardcore scene. It's usually just a year or two.
Yeah. Most of the people that have come up to me, like, you know, you write for The Hard Times. I love that website. It's like 35 and above jaded hardcore dude. And it's like, all right, there we go. Target demo right there. So
if you're still like really in the thick of it and you're in a band and you believe you're going to change the world or whatever, some of the absurdity that we're pointing out, I think it doesn't land quite as hard. Mm-hmm. There are people who enjoy it like that and writers on our staff who are like that, but I definitely see it if you've fallen away from it a bit. I think it becomes more funny.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Because when I look at the hardcore world, and I'm not like entirely clued in on how it operates these days, but it's just interesting to me when I think back to all these times as a kid where just so much violence seemed completely normal. So many weird character types that just wouldn't be acceptable in like the real world and stuff. And I think that is the real beauty of what you guys created at first, at least, was like, let's just like call attention to these things and present them in a way that inherently is just putting a light on how odd this world is.
The characters in the punk scene are fucking weird, man. Mm. And the violence, I remember when I was after college, I was in like my first job, and I started realizing a lot of people around me had never been in a fight before, and that I was the weird one.
Right.
Well, that's the thing, like hardcore desensitizes you to violence so much, and I've like grown up skateboarding and going to hardcore shows, and I just remember this one time I was in San Francisco and I saw some drunk lady walk out of a bar and just face plant and just like didn't care, you know, it's just like, you know, that's what happens, you know, like you idiot, but like most people would have empathy and be like, oh my God, are you okay? But it's like, yeah, I should be fucking fine, get out of here, you know, but it's just, yeah, that's I guess my friend of mine went to an Integrity show last night in Portland and was like, yeah, Bouncer just got fucked up pretty bad. He tried to put a dude in a headlock for no apparent reason.
Really?
Like, yeah, well, that's what's going to happen is you're going to try to act tough at a hardcore show as a bouncer and people are going to...
Tale as old as time, man. The bouncer doesn't understand that everyone in the crowd and the band are all friends. And
I've seen bouncers get hospitalized repeatedly when I was like 18 at shows.
Yeah.
I just started noticing at Gilman, which is where I kind of grew up going to shows,
right. There
used to be some real deal bouncers who would actually try to enforce the no stage diving rule. And in recent years, not really at all. I remember as a kid, I don't know what band I was seeing. It might have been Monster Squad or something. I remember this bouncer picking this kid up and giving him like a military press slam off the stage.
That's much safer than stage diving.
Right. So how would you guys describe your own personal hardcore pedigrees that allowed you to even get to the point of having a perspective on this that has obviously paid off, and you're both independently rich off of this website,
of course,
I'm assuming?
Yeah, we had the Maserati over here. Well, I'm a bit older than Matt. I'm going to be 35 in a month. So I came up in like the Boston hardcore scene, like 1999 to like 2005 was when I was probably most active there.
So that really trips me out because that was like the same exact time that I was going to shows in Boston and stuff since I grew up in New Hampshire.
Yeah, but we were probably at some of the same shows then. Mm-hmm. I mean, ICC
witnessed a lot
Church.
Of the same. Yeah, yeah. A lot of the same insanity. Like I think of the ICC Church, I think about Ramallah's first show, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. I was actually lucky enough when I interviewed White Trash Rob when I got to talk to him about that. But that was like a show where there's a lot of like various crew members who maybe were in retirement, you know, they're like 30 something, or they seem like they were probably 30 something to me at the time.
Right, they were 22. Right, they're just a rough looking 22.
Me at 18, I'm like, you are an old motherfucker. You are big and you are scary. But like, I felt like a lot of dudes came out of retirement to fuck people up at that show. And that like in Boston, it's like kind of hard for people to maybe understand that like the number of people who are getting horrifically injured at an average hardcore show was kind of the sign of how well the band did.
Well, and then you have like Tiger's Den / Romans, which I kind of like avoided going to mainly because there's like a dude that's like 17 years old pushing 250 pounds that can spin kick, you know, right. And you're just like, dude, band's just tuning right now. Like,
that was
chill.
like a gym of like insane yeah. violence. Shout out to Chris Mission. I wonder where he's at in his life right now.
Yeah, I think he's jumping out of windows.
Oh my god, you heard
down.
That story too? Yeah. Huh? Oh my god, see that would be the craziest interview ever to get his perspective on what happened in that. I heard he like lost a couple inches of height.
Yeah, when you jump out of a second story window of a man of his carriage, it's yeah. gonna happen.
It's crazy that we both know about that, and that it's like I don't talk to anyone who's like close to it and stuff. This is just like hardcore lore of yeah. the time. And
wait,
if he
so
was
he
still
jumped out a window, wait, I don't know. You so, Boston people are talking about what's
yeah,
going on.
There was I don't really know what led to it, but there was a guy. He ran like a record label stuff. Uh-huh. People got mad at him. They went to his apartment. It was called the Zoo. It was in Rockland. They went upstairs. He escaped by jumping out the window.
Yeah, and it was crazy.
And he was like never to be seen again.
Right, and if he was still a part of the world that he was a part of at that time, then there's no way that I would feel comfortable sitting here and talking about that incident because this is like right. a very menacing yeah, entity yeah. at the right. time. Well, and then
do you
that
ever
happens.
See Return to the Pit on like Instagram or anything like that?
Because I still get tagged once in a while yeah. in some old photos.
So
yeah.
I saw him like pop up in a photo the other day. I was like, "Fucking Chris Mission! I have not thought about that dude right. in like 10, 15 years."
He
like,
was an icon on the B9 board.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of ellipses. Yeah. You recall that?
I wasn't very frequent on the Bridge 9 board because I don't know why. I think I was on Lambgoat more.
See, I remember the first time I ever looked at Lambgoat, and I remember thinking, if I read this message board every day, then I will start to hate this stuff. And then within like 6 months, I was on B9 every day.
I was on B9. I started the... Also, I was from the Bay Area, so we had like more community meetings, you know, where I was like outvoted, and that was like our big tiffs. Mm. Less violence in general.
Wow.
But... I was on the B9 board. I ran the Minecraft server for the B9 board. That
wow.
was me.
That's amazing. I really hate the fact that I don't have Minecraft as part of my like upbringing.
Dude, Minecraft was so much fun. Yeah, we ran, a couple friends and I, it was a mix between B9 and VLV, and we had a Minecraft server, and it was a lot of fun.
Wow.
What do you do on Minecraft anyway?
You build.
Like you mine and you craft.
Oh, all right. Fair enough.
You know the guy who...
No further explanation
The
needed.
Guy who invented Minecraft is like a fucking mm-hmm. lunatic now.
And he used to throw a ton of parties up in the valley or wherever in this huge mansion of his. And now he just still... I mean, he will talk on Twitter as if he's not a billionaire. Like, he just says whatever the fuck he wants to say. It's like reading like a little like edgelord type dude talking.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes I really agree with the shit he's saying. Sometimes I'm like, I cannot believe that you're concerning yourself with this.
It's always like, if there's Gay Pride Day, there might as well be Sexual Pride Day. It's like, dude, what's going on, man?
Shout out Notch.
Yeah.
He needs like a Joe Rogan. I'm not even going to petition for him to be on here.
I personally messaged the booker of Joe Rogan to say, please get Notch on Joe Rogan because I want to listen to it.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's amazing. Joe Rogan was a Quake addict. He never was a Minecraft guy, I don't think.
I didn't play that much Quake.
I played it for a little bit, but that was like 1997.
Yeah. So, two of my biggest interests growing up was punk, and then my other interest was video games. So we started a video game website too. It's called Hard Drive. It's like a subsection of the Hard Times, and it's fucking blowing up, man.
Why was that the obvious next vertical to explore? Just because it's a huge industry as opposed to hardcore, which is fairly tiny, which is why it's kind of amazing to me that you guys have reached like the scale that you have.
It's weird, right?
Yeah.
I would have never expected that many people to be that interested in Hard Times.
I would not expect, like, you guys have like 400,000 Facebook likes. I'm like, I'm surprised that there's 400,000 people that even like get these jokes at all.
Millions of people go to our website every month. And I sometimes go, who are these people?
Right, yeah. I never would have thought that it could get this big when I first saw it.
Like, wow. 600 people from the Philippines? What? you look at the stats.
I had plenty of, I started doing stand-up comedy a while back, and I had plenty of stand-up comics friends when I lived in Portland. Like, how many jokes are you going to be able to make about punk and hardcore? Yeah. And like, I don't know. I'm just going to keep doing them until we don't.
That was a thing, right? Everyone thought we'd run out.
Yeah, it's like, just fuck you guys. We're trying to create something. Shut up.
Is the video game side of things way bigger than the other side?
Or? It is already about equal, and it's pacing. It's only a year and a half in, and it's definitely going to end up being bigger. That world is just huge. We actually tried a couple verticals before that didn't work out. We tried one about MMA and pro wrestling and alternative sports, and just no one read it.
Really? Yeah. That's really interesting. I wonder why.
The big thing we discovered is, I think with MMA fans in particular, like, they don't have a sense of humor, unless it's like Ronda Rousey getting kicked in the face and the caption just says, like, bitch. You know, like, that's like the funniest thing in the world. But like, subtle jokes about Mike Goldberg, like, aren't funny.
Right. This is like this, but this is like the writers being mad at the audience, right? Maybe our stuff just wasn't good enough.
It was fucking good, man. Go back and look at it. They're funny headlines.
We tried another one called Truth Bang, which was a conspiracy theory website where we had created this character who had all these outlandish conspiracy theories, but the headlines were so insane no one could share it.
Really?
Yeah, it was one of those things you wouldn't want popping up on your like Facebook, because like you know you're friends with your parents on Facebook and like, why are you sharing this thing about gay frogs?
Yeah, it was too intense for anyone to publicly enjoy. So
wow, that is so interesting. Yeah, it kind of raises the question of like, what kind of subculture lends itself towards a satire website? Mm-hmm. And maybe MMA is just not like a refined enough world, because if you think about video games or you think about hardcore, it's like, it's sort of a nuanced world where you have, there's a fairly high standard that you have to like educate yourself on before you can really consider yourself to be a participant. Like with UFC, it's much easier to be a casual fan, I'm guessing.
I guess, I don't know. I guess each audience has its own sort of taste and personality, right? And satire is a particular form of comedy. I don't think every audience is that interested in it? And then also maybe Bill and I just didn't have the perspective that they were looking for, right?
Mm. Well, I think, like you were saying, a lot of casual fans of like the UFC will know Conor McGregor and Jon Jones, but they won't know the guy on the undercard or something like that. And if you're making a specific joke about some guy, it's like, well, the diehards will get this, but have they looked at this site, or they don't care because they take it so seriously? Like, how dare they joke about this precious thing? You know, so who knows?
Yeah. I think punks and hardcore kids didn't have much of their own comedy outlet, so it felt like it was missing, and so they all really embraced it very quickly and shared it with all their friends. And then I feel like with video game people, they're all online anyways, and they're very big into fandom stuff and sharing things that they like. So I think that was probably the success behind those two things.
Yeah, there's a real sense in like the video game, the online community, that you're like, you're all contributing to memes, that you're all sort of working towards spreading ideas of you know, and working towards like refining better and better jokes. Yeah. Whereas like, I don't know that attitude has necessarily like manifested itself in the MMA world. Although I feel like that there's got to be, like, as time goes by or as that community gets tighter, that there has to be an ability for that to unfold.
There's definitely already a sense of humor in the MMA world, and there's some big humor, like Derek Lewis, My Balls Was Hot.
Oh yeah,
oh, that was,
you
great
know, he has that Instagram page that's kind of like the MMA comedy outlet, right? It's just people dying on motorcycles and
right
stuff.
Yeah, which is, you know, shows like that I've definitely a refined sense of humor. It's big into subtleties and tone and things like that. Yeah, but Derek Lewis, that guy is definitely a character for sure.
And it's just so weird to see somebody who's such a big, monstrous murderer, who's just the toughest dude you ever seen in your life, and then his Instagram is like this goofy-ass, like, little girl type vibe. Yeah. It's like, he's just having so much fun with being himself.
It's impossible not to like him. Yeah, I like Derek Lewis a lot. I actually saw MMA live for the very first time in my life. Recently, I went to Japan, and I saw Ryzen, their New Year's Eve event. I saw Tenshin fight Mayweather.
How was that? Oh, you went to that? That's amazing.
It was fucking awesome, man. Have you guys seen MMA live?
I've just went to one bad event in Portland, two bad events in Portland. It was a Bellator and a UFC, and they were both kind of weak. I went to a Strikeforce in the Bay Area when Fedor got triangled by Fabricio Verdum, and it was like the worst night of my life.
Oh, my God. That was a depressing night. To see him go down in such a hoe-ass match, like, it just didn't really feel like this was like an appropriate way for him to sort of lose his legacy.
That was Dana White's whole thing about him, right? Was that he was one punch away from being worth nothing. Mm. Remember that when they were trying to like do like a co-promote to get him Fedor in there with Brock or Randy Couture or something?
Best fighter all time, they'll never fight in the UFC ever, right?
Yeah, probably. Well, I would say. But yeah, that night he lost to Fabricio. Like I went to San Jose from the Bay Area like by myself because I didn't have any friends that watched it. And like I was like dating this girl at the time and I texted her like right when Fedor like lost. I was like, I'm going to go break edge because I've been straight edge forever. She's like, are you serious? And I was like, yeah, I'm fucking serious.
That's funny as fuck. The only fight I ever been to was in Vegas, UFC, the Conor McGregor fight where he fucking hopped over the fence. And,
you were there?
Yeah. That's the only one I ever been to. And I mean, for people at home, they don't understand, I don't think, because I didn't really realize until I was sitting there, is that it's just silent. It's like this massive arena and everyone's quiet pretty much until somebody gets hurt and then you hear some yelling and stuff. Because when you're watching at home, you're really tuned into the commentary, at least myself, you know?
Yeah. Dude, in Japan, they have like a culture where the fans remain almost completely quiet. It sounds like a fucking library with, you know, 50,000 people there.
Right.
It's really weird. You can hear like guys in the ring coughing and stuff and talking to their corner men. It's weird.
That was a big thing with like watching Pride is you could hear all the commentary all the time, you know, from the corners.
And it's considered rude to stand up. So like, even when something crazy happens, all you do is like.
Japan is such a polite society that it almost is kind of shocking to me that they even embrace MMA in any way, because it does seem so like unpalatable to a culture that's like overall kind of meek and like doesn't seem attracted towards like
they got some warrior elements of their culture though. They're into violence.
I guess they don't spot violence. It when I'm just walking around. You know, it's like
Well, they love those mismatches like Bob Sapp versus like a guy in a wheelchair or something like that. That will get him going.
Who's that? Gabby Garcia, the steroid monster. I saw her. She was at the Ryzen event too.
Didn't she fought like a 60-year-old woman on that or something?
It was brutal.
Like that?
Yeah.
Bob Sapp was an amazing era. I remember when I first found out about Bob Sapp, and I'm just sitting there watching all these like super pixelated videos of him in like 2006, and just losing my mind. Like, I cannot believe they let this guy fight looking like this. Like, yeah, I miss that steroid.
Did you ever buy the Bob Sapp album or anything like that?
There's an album.
He's got like a love song, like a Barry White sort of love song album, where he's on the cover, like with his shirt off. I haven't listened to it, but I'm assuming it's great.
That's holy amazing. Shit,
dude! There's a lot of people who have bizarre music careers that you wouldn't know about.
Well, who are you thinking of? Who comes to mind?
I interviewed Hulk Hogan about his music career.
Yeah, the Wrestling Boot Band.
The Wrestling Boot
Band.
Everybody
knows that.
And then I interviewed Sergeant Slaughter, and Sergeant Slaughter put out a record too.
Sergeant Slaughter, who like actually made me cry as a child because I was so scared that like I really thought I was watching like the Iraq War play out in front of me in the wrestling ring as a kid, dude.
Yeah, when he turned on America. That's such a good heel turn.
Was he was the one who burnt Hulk Hogan's face backstage?
Yeah,
right?
That was Fireball. And I think that was him.
I had no space to understand that that wasn't real. And my mom tried to tell me it wasn't real. And I started crying my eyes out. She still brings it up to this day.
That's good.
Yeah.
She'll just text you randomly if you're starting to she thinks you're getting too big or something like that.
Yeah,
like, the time you cried over Hulk Hogan.
Exactly. Like, remember when you were crying your eyes out? You didn't understand how Hulk Hogan had a movie coming out the next week. You thought that he was going to be hurt. I'm like, all right.
What was it, like Thunder in Paradise or whatever?
Suburban Commando. Come on.
Was Thunder in Paradise one of his movies? I remember I had a VHS of him like riding boats. That was like a big, it was like a boat action movie.
I feel like you've talked about this before and you had the same thing where you couldn't remember it, but it's like a Mandela effect.
My family only had like, you know, it was weird when I was growing up, like we didn't have like the access to all these different movies. So we just had like 50 VHSs and that's like all we watched. Right. And one of them was a movie where Hulk Hogan was an action star. It was based in Miami, I think. And he was on like really fast boats.
I don't recall it. It hurts me that I don't recall that. I really feel like I need to like re-educate myself. Oh my God. So let me just ask you something that none of us are in any way prepared or equipped to talk about.
Let's do it.
Is the Hulk Hogan thing where they catch him saying a bunch of racist shit and then they kick him out of the Hall of Fame, but now he's back, right? Mm-hmm.
Hulk still rules, baby.
Yeah. What do you think of that? It seems almost like so pointless to have kicked him out of the Hall of Fame in the first place if they're just going to let him in.
Did they let him back in or did they make a big deal?
I think it was relatively quiet, right?
Okay, well, I think that they sold a big event to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia or something. And the Crown Prince...
He's got a lot of pull.
And he said, I want Hulk Hogan at my event. I think that was when Hulk Hogan came back to WWE at first.
Wow, okay.
And I remember that Prince guy from Saudi Arabia. I think it was Saudi Arabia. I think so. And he was listing off wrestlers that he wanted that were like dead. You know what I mean?
Ultimate Warrior, Macho Man Randy Savage, Luna Vachon.
And so all these guys came back. Like, it was, you know, Shawn Michaels is fucking retired, right? But then he came back for this Saudi Arabia money. And Hulk Hogan was there. And I remember watching. It was so weird because the first rows, it wasn't fans. It was like royalty and members of the government. And they were standing up with their backs turned and like having discussions and stuff. And I was like, dude, this is fucking disrespectful.
I love that idea that you become a billionaire and then you take your riches and you just dump them into making the Americans do stupid things for money.
I love it. The Hulk Hogan N-word thing. I remember like after that happened, all the shirts that say Hulk still rules all of a sudden have a completely new meaning. So all these people walking around, Hulk still rules, you know, a week ago it's fine, but now
it's like a MAGA hat all of a sudden.
Same colors and shit.
It's really changed up its shit. Were you a big Suicide File fan as well?
Suicide File was my favorite Boston hardcore band.
More, I can say from that era, 100%. Blood for Blood probably my overall meant more to me or something. But Suicide File blew my mind. American Nightmare 2 would probably be the other one. But that was a really amazing era.
One of the like biggest regrets is that I didn't get into the Suicide File final show at the ICC. Like I lived around the corner, went over there, and it was sold out. But I guess a bunch of people had parked a Jeep by a window and were just climbing in. I was like, nobody told me about the damn Jeep. You know?
My God.
But I would just like sit outside seeing people having a great time. I'm like, fuck. Me, you know, this sucks, but
it hurts.
Yeah, but I got to see a couple of the reunions, so that was fine. But
right, they have done a bunch of reunions, huh? So, what do you guys' involvement with the hardcore scene as is look like? It's often like an awkward thing to get old and still be a hardcore fan.
Let's see. Well, since
we book a bunch of shows, we just booked Gorilla Biscuits. We booked some of my favorite bands. We booked Judge. We interview a whole bunch of hardcore and punk dudes. We're interviewing Wes from American Nightmare on Monday.
Wow, that's awesome.
Last week, we had Keith Morris on our podcast, and he took out his dick and pissed during the middle of our interview.
Yeah. Just on the ground? Or?
we were on the phone with him, so we got to hear the urine on water / porcelain.
Wow, I love that dynamic when I'm doing a little phone meeting with somebody and I'm trying to pee like quietly. I'll sit down so that there's not it's not hitting the water as loudly, and then I'll like rush away as I flush.
You gotta get a yardstick and hit it from the other room.
Give it a little tap over in this other room. Yeah, that's a fact. So is booking hardcore shows like a dangerous, risky proposal at this point, or is it all right?
Not for me. I've been booking shows as soon as I start going on tour. You know, I would make friends and they would book a show and 50 kids would come here. They let me sleep at their place. So I would always say, like, whenever you guys come back, I'll make sure to do the same for you. And so I have
like
friends.
A Gorilla Biscuit show has got to be out of hand. Like, there's a million people trying to go to that.
That one was actually kind of a bummer because I had a lot of people who knew me from way back asking for tickets, but we didn't have any left.
And I was getting texts from people like out of the woodwork, people that had moved from Massachusetts like to the Bay Area, and like, hey, like the day of, like I live in LA.
Don't
I'm not
be
even
that
going
guy.
To the show. But I can't do anything for you.
We're lucky. We have a live events guy. His name is Nick. And he handles a lot of it for us. And so we don't have to get intimately involved. Because when you do get intimately involved, you get a lot of drama and backlash. Why didn't you book my fucking band? All that sort of stuff.
He takes all the emotional labor and the real labor, too. He does all that.
He does a good job. We are working on, so for the people who missed Gorilla Biscuits, we are working on, it's not announced yet, but some sort of big event with some New York hardcore bands. I'm really happy to meet all those guys and book some of their shows. Because we did Judge. We did Burn, we did Gorilla Biscuits, we did Shelter, H2O. So I've really got to know some of those dudes, and now they always like hard time shows. So we're going to try to coordinate something where they all come back kind of at once.
On the way over here, I skated back by Toby Morse. So like as I was skating over here, I was like, oh, it was Toby. And then I skated 20 more feet, and then Shepherd Fairey was eating lunch at a diner. I was like, LA's weird.
You saw all that on the way here?
Yeah.
I saw Merle Allen walking by the other day.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, that was amazing. looking crusty as fuck with some jacket with paint all over it.
I had heard that Merle Allen didn't like hard times. It was really early on. We did a kind of a lot of Gigi Allen jokes, and I had heard that Merle was upset.
I can see that.
Gigi's such a sympathetic character.
Like disrespecting his legacy.
Whenever I think about Gigi Allen, I'm like forced to think about like how his career would be different if he had been born 20 years later, or like how the world out there might react to a man shoving a banana up his ass on stage like, these days.
Like Gigi Allen, then you go to Anal Cunt or something like that, and just like there would not have been, like, I mean, people would go to their house and burn them with torches.
Right. It would be very different now.
I like how every town has the one Gigi Allen impersonator in the scene. I love that. There's like, it doesn't matter where you go in the U.S., each scene has like the one guy with like the fucked up Gigi Allen facial hair and like smells like shit, but he's like living it.
You know? You find out he was in a car accident or something, so it's like he's not all there, and you're like, oh, I kind of feel bad. But
you remember,
what's he doing?
There was a band called Drug Test.
I remember the band, yeah.
Right, and there was a dude in that band called Slick Rick, and he's from Manchester, New Hampshire, and I remember bringing up Gigi Allen one time around him and him just sort of saying like, oh yeah, I remember that guy fucking, and he was basically saying that Gigi Allen used to be downtown Manchester and he would actually like expose himself. There'd be like kids around, he'd expose himself, and he's like, yeah, we used to beat the fuck out of that dude. And then that forced me to like think about what being around Gigi Allen would have really been like. If you're not worshiping him as some like punk rock god, then he's just some weirdo who's pulling his dick out on the street.
He's the worst.
Of course somebody's gonna beat him up. Yeah, he's like, really, he would really be in jail like immediately now.
I was at Punk Rock Bowling. I was hanging out with my friend Lisa. She runs New Noise magazine, and she pointed at someone and goes, "That guy, Gigi Allen, died on his couch." And I remember thinking, I wonder how often people whisper that around this guy as he walks around punk events. Like, that's his claim to fame. Wow. That Gigi died on his couch.
That is a pretty good claim.
Well, it was
to
on
fame.
The back of his jacket. Like, yeah. Asking me about my couch. And yeah.
Like, well, one thing that you guys and Gigi Allen have a lot in common is they both are very big on Facebook. I noticed that when I was trying to figure out how to contact Merle Allen, and I fucking found his, he runs the Gigi Allen fan Facebook, and I messaged him trying to get an interview, didn't get a response. So Merle Allen, I'm just like throwing that out into the universe. If anybody's got a plug.
Probably watching.
I mean, he's walking up and down Melrose with some girl like a couple weeks ago. I've seen him. So
just run up to him.
I see. I would have, but it didn't really click into my head. And I actually said to one of my friends, I'm like, that's fucking Gigi Allen's brother. And then he turned around and I was like, that. And I was like, because I didn't really know. I was like, is this just a guy in a murder junkie's hand-painted leather jacket?
Yeah, he's still, you could just talk about him, like, about New Hampshire with him, you know, and be like, yeah, come on, man.
I think the murder junkies still play, don't they?
I think probably, yeah.
Yeah, I think one of my friends was telling me they play with him.
That's amazing. Yeah, so when you the guys, like, I just think it's funny that you guys do so well on Facebook, because Facebook obviously has a huge fake news problem, and then you guys are essentially a fake news site, regardless of how knowing you are about it and everything. Yeah. But it's just bizarre to see you guys be sort of like one of the last like websites that still seems to get really good Facebook engagement on just links.
Yeah, despite what Facebook has tried, we still continue to do okay. But they've put in like some of their things to get rid of fake news has affected our traffic as a in general. Like, we'd probably, I don't know, billionaire probably be
close. So when we first started, we would put out a joke a day, right? And Facebook would, if it was a good joke and punk kids wanted to share it, they would show it to 1 million or 2 million people, even if, let's say, 30,000-40,000 people liked our Facebook page. Like, it would go all over the place because people really like our content, so they would share it with all their friends. Nowadays, the same amount of shares and Facebook will show it to like 100,000, 200,000 people. So they really have like tried to kind of squash sites like ours out, but our fans are just so rabid and loyal that we're still around. Still kicking.
I remember like one of the when I first started to see your site, one of the fun parts about it would be to scroll down and see how many people didn't get the joke in the comments. But does that really occur anymore?
All the time.
Oh, still, okay.
Dude, so it's like some sort of math equation where it's like 0.001% of people will just take everything literally. And so the amount of people that read our website, like, there's just 10 people like that every day, you know?
And those are always the most vocal people. Like, the dumbest people are the ones that are quickest to type on a computer, which is always the strangest thing to me. Like,
but then you also have like an army of people who are happy to tell them, like, it's a satire set, you stupid idiot. Yeah. Let's leave 40 fucking comments responding to this dude.
And then that person usually responds back, well, satire is supposed to be funny. I'm like, oh, you got us.
Oh. Our readers are the best, man, because I feel like they always defend us and attack anyone who says anything negative about us. Like, I don't have to do anything. You know what I mean? Like, say one thing in our comments about how we're not doing something wrong, and you just, like, a swarm of people.
Right. They want to defend your right to exist, which is nice.
So one time The Onion posted a Youth of Today headline. And
wait, they did? I don't remember this.
Yeah, something about, it's about a Youth of Today shirt. But it's an old headline. It's like from 2006, before Our Side existed. And they reposted it on their Facebook page. And a whole bunch of people went and were like, you're stealing the Hard Times gimmick. And this thing is from 5 years before we existed. I was like, thanks for defending us, guys, but you're just completely off.
I wonder Onion writer at that time knew about Youth of Today. That's kind of
There's a couple hardcore ones on there. Hmm. There must have been some guy.
Yeah, I just remember like Yola Tango headlines every now and again on The Onion from way back when. You know, but
one of the best things I ever seen in my life, and I hate that I'm about to implicate myself of having witnessed this, but I was on tour with a band called Black My Heart, as well as a band called, well, Bury Your Dead. You probably remember them and stuff. Like them and On Broken Wings, I think was the tour. And so they played Magic Fest in Orlando, and Youth of Today were headlining. And so Ray Capo's up there just looking ancient as shit. And there's just a wall of straight edge kids just like this with their backs turned, just throwing the X up. And I mean, Ray Capo did not have some like glorious edge break or something. It's kind of hard to understand what they were even protesting.
I think I've seen a picture of that.
Right,
of probably, them turning their backs and doing it's because of the wine in Italy, right? Wasn't that the whole thing?
It was something like he had a glass of wine in his daughter's wedding. Like this, fucking is, you're protesting this? Like that seems important enough to protest? Okay.
Yeah, I did a podcast for 3 years. It's actually how I met Matt, called Edgeland, where I talked with straight edge people. I had Ray Capo on.
Wow.
And I, you know, I told him via email, like, here's what it's about, you know. And then when I brought up, like, it's like, you know, talking about straight edge, he's like, fuck straight edge, fuck this, fuck that. Like, my mom doesn't drink, my mom doesn't do drugs, she's straight edge. Like, I don't know, man. Like,
wow.
Do you not want to be here right now? But then he like texted me the next day. He's like, you can't release that interview. So there's a lost Ray Capo edition of my former podcast. But yeah, and there was like 5 minutes in the middle of it where he just stopped and talked to somebody on the street of New York, you know, and just like, I was just on Skype with him like, need to go, Ray.
That sounds so crazy. I thought about reaching out to him for an interview at one point when I saw a picture of him doing yoga in Long Beach. And then, one of my friends was like, I don't know if you'd want to interview him. It might kind of fuck up your like childhood idea of what Ray Capo was all about.
I met him a couple times. He's real nice. Porcel let me interview him several times. I interviewed Porcel for Noisy, and I interviewed him for my old punk scene.
Yeah, Purcell's great.
Yeah, Purcell is very charitable with his time. Actually, okay, I remember I went into Youth of the Day's van in Oakland, and I said, can I interview you guys? And Ray Capo said, do you know your shit? And I said, I think I do. And he said, if I'm going to let someone interview me, they need to know their shit. And then I think he left. Purcell was like, you can interview me.
I kind of like that, though, because I understand where he's coming from. You ever see that Nardwar interview with Henry Rollins, where Henry Rollins is about to kick him out? And then he's basically like, he goes, you got any more questions? And Nardwar says like 20 questions in a row that are really good questions. And Rollins is forced to like break his exterior and be like, all right, like you're legit. Like he thought this guy was a total goofball, and then he realizes that he actually knows what he's talking about.
Nardwar's the best, man. One of the like the highlights for me running Hard Times was when Nardwar posted a couple of our things. That was like a peak moment for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's got to be glorious. Is there anything that stands out like that? Like a fucking Kim Kardashian fucking screenshot and something you wrote or something like that? Anything equivalent? Maybe PewDiePie did it, right?
PewDiePie.
You guys had some, what was it, like accidentally dons a Klansman outfit? Was that you guys?
Yeah. I was like intimately involved in that headline, and we were going back and forth between a Nazi outfit and a Klan outfit. And I remember I was very hard on the side of a Klan outfit because I thought it was more ridiculous, especially because he's not from America. but he really let that one roll off his shoulders, and he shared it. Notch shared one of our things. We wrote some headline about Notch that was like, guy builds functioning computer inside of Minecraft that can block Notch on Twitter. and Notch shared that one.
He was into it, though. He thought it was funny.
Yeah, he's like I think he tweeted and he said something like, I was debating whether or not to share this, but it is a really good joke, so here we go.
Yeah, I really respect anybody who can take a joke about themselves, because that's a certain skill that a lot of people don't have.
Yeah, for sure, man. Dude, honestly, a lot of people in the punk scene who I like kind of grew up, their music straight up changed my life, ended up being fans of the website, so many that it's kind of hard to list. But I get to hang out with some of them, and I get to talk to them, and it's pretty great.
That's amazing. I mean, seeing like Brian Baker of Minor Threat wearing one of our shirts on stage, it's just like, I have 2 Minor Threat tattoos. Like, this isn't supposed to happen right now. Like, come on, amazing. Man. Like,
the guys from Op Ivy liked the website, and like Lars from Rancid came on our podcast, and I got to kind of become friends with him, and that's been a real thrill. I grew up, Rancid was a huge band for me growing up.
That's glorious.
Yeah.
That must have been huge. I think I have actually texted with him back and forth, and we were supposed to do it at some point, but we haven't actually locked down the time.
Yeah, dude. Lars is great. He was a great podcast guest. Yeah.
Really?
That guy can, he just knows how to be interviewed. Like, that guy, like, just give him something and he'll give you a lot.
That's a great skill to have.
He's had such an incredible life story. So all you have to do is ask him about something and he'll go off. Like he told us all about getting in this fight with a Nazi skinhead and getting stabbed and by a beer bottle and trying to stitch it up with some fishing line.
Holy shit. That was a big theme in Boston Beatdown too, which was a big part of my hardcore education, was like just showing Colin of Arabia and these dudes like sewing themselves up. And that it's just so insane to think that that was something that that was being glorified, and that I was a fucking 18-year-old dude sitting there watching and thinking, that's fucking awesome. And in retrospect, I'm not really sure why I thought that.
Yeah, I forget who I was recently talking with about Boston Beatdown, but they were like, was that like a real thing that like happened? Like, yeah, you know, it was in like young kids wanted, like in the next generation coming up, tried to imitate it, and it got worse and worse for a little while until I think it got like peak shitty and then just kind of stopped and reset.
I think that they really kind of fucked themselves over too, because like all the violence in Boston and hardcore shows and stuff was sort of like easy to ignore. All the crew stuff was kind of easy for the cops to ignore and everything, but then they put out this DVD that everybody's talking about. That changed everything, where all of a sudden you couldn't wear shirts with fucking certain crews at shows there. You couldn't like, you know, it's just like the crackdown. It's like cops all of a sudden realize like, oh, we could treat this shit just like regular street gangs.
Yeah, dude. That's in the Bay Area, we didn't have a Boston Beatdown thing. I remember watching that DVD and being like, Boston is fucking stupid, dude. What's wrong with these?
I remember looking at like fucking Bay Area stuff and thinking, these guys are pussies. Exactly. They don't mosh hard enough.
Exactly. Circle pits. What the hell is that shit?
So the closest thing that we had, right, is that we had a DVD called Ramen Days, and it was about Burnt Ramen, which was a DIY venue in Richmond. And it was kind of like a reaction to Gilman and all of Gilman's rules. And the quote, like the tagline for Burnt Ramen, was an unsafe place for all ages. And the rule was they let the fights go. And I remember watching that DVD and being pretty like I was into it. I was like, this fucking wild club. And we actually got to play there a whole bunch of times.
They let the fights go. As an adult who kind of understands the concept of an insurance policy and of like risk and everything, it's just like, you could let them fight. Dude, of course you can't let them fight.
This place has been shut down 30 or 40 times. Wow. Like, I don't know how they ended up doing shows for so long. It was a gnarly place.
Just the city of Richmond in general is a gnarly place.
Oh, yeah. I remember going to shows there. And one time we had a show and got in a call a couple hours before, and the show was shut down because there was a shooting right outside the venue. You know, Ramen was actually like the safe place compared to the fucking neighborhood, right? So my band, we did this really kind of annoying, shitty thing where I pretended to be a pro wrestling character, a bad guy. Uh-huh. And I would brag about how rich I was and shit. And so my band rented a limo and brought it to Burnt Ramen and like hung out in the limo outside the show. We didn't have enough money to get the limo to stay the whole time though, so we had to like drive to the venue beforehand, unload our gear, then drive back, get in a limo, and then take the limo, and then the limo left before we played.
Holy shit.
But yeah,
that's amazing. Let me ask you this, is from a business perspective, what is it like running a popular blog these days? Do you just slap some ads on the site, or what's the monetization strategy?
Yeah, so we've got a couple different revenue streams. Ads are a big one. I had to learn a lot about that, right? So my background is a journalist, and then I got into comedy writing. Pretty much what happened was, I wrote this article about a man who had sex with a dolphin.
It's a biographical piece. Autobiographical.
He wrote a book about it, right? And I went to go interview him. And it was this goofy-ass interview with this guy who fucked a dolphin and is super open about it. He thinks he has a psychic connection with this dolphin, right? So this is a weird interview. I released this interview for SF Weekly, and it goes viral, like all over the world, right? Mm. And I remember being so excited, and I was sitting there, I was watching the share counters go up, up, up.
Great feeling.
I got a call from my editor, you need to do a follow-up.
SF Weekly was on GeoCities at that time, so it had the little counter at the bottom, and so cursor tracked a pixie dust behind it. It was a really cool website.
The publisher, who's like the highest up at each magazine, told me how proud he was, and I need to do more. It was the most viewed article of the year.
You need more incest pieces, Matt. It's bestiality. Yeah. What do I have on my mind, huh?
So he goes,
too much Game of Thrones.
I'm super excited about it, but I only get $35. And the fact that it did super well, it doesn't change my bottom line at all, right? Mm. And I wrote the article. I took the photo. I went. I met the guy. You know, I paid for parking, all this sort of stuff. And I started to think, when it went super viral, I was like, what's stopping me from owning the website if I'm the guy who's making the content, right? And how much money did they make for the fucking publisher to call me? Mm. Right? Like, what's going on here? And so that was pretty much when I decided, okay, I want to own a website. And then once you own a website, we were lucky enough that ours became popular. So we do ads, but we also do live events. We do some intellectual property stuff. Like, we have a book coming out later this year. So you could get an advance for that.
We do sponsored content.
We have a podcast now, and we've sold podcast ads. It's kind of like, you know, there's, I think, about like 3 or 4 million views on the website each month. And you get, you know, a couple bucks for every 1,000 views. Mm-hmm. If you set up your website the right way, it takes a really long time and a lot of work to figure it out. Mm. But once you get it down,
I think it's funny now when people like, cause people ask, like, I want to start a satire site. Like, got any tips? Be like, go back in time and try again, because Facebook has fucked over monetization online basically as a whole. So
yeah, you know, if we would have started this publication, our business would have been a lot healthier. If we, you know, if you were to become this popular of a publisher back in the 10
years before,
it's a lot more money. The actual publishing industry is going through a real rough time. Pretty much what's happening is, used to be like Ray-Ban or fucking Vans or whatever.
Cons and shit.
They would find individual magazines and they would buy from them. And nowadays what people do is they buy from Google, and Google spreads it out all over the place. It's called programmatic ads.
Right.
So it's like when you do a YouTube video and you get like that 35% cut, that's like what was like being an online publisher today, running a magazine. It used to be that people go directly to you and you get 100% of it.
I remember, because my BMX website that I started in 2006, I remember I had a month where, and when this was still the game, and where there was a bunch of video game companies, because I had like a network who was just like getting me advertisement campaigns and stuff, and they were getting video game ads out the ass. I remember I made 10 grand one month. Best. And I about shit my fucking pants, because this is like 2007 and I could not believe it. And then like the next month, the 2008 financial crash hits, boom, that never happened again. The 10 grand turned into like 1500 and then that eventually shriveled up and went away. So that was, I lived through that misery.
Yeah, so that ad network was getting you those direct ad sales. Which is that business is kind of going away,
right? But, because everybody can just go to Facebook or Google, and even me, like when I think about like, oh, like if we have something we want to advertise, oh, we have the shirt design that's like doing really well, maybe we should just try to get this in front of as many eyeballs as possible. It's like, oh, well, maybe we should get a consultant to help us with Facebook and Google ads. That's like the obvious. It's path. The standard. What right else now. Are you going to do now?
We're pretty lucky. We have some really cool ad partners who they've identified our audience as being specific enough to who they're trying to market to, where they still come direct to us, and we can actually beat, this is getting kind of nerdy now, but we can actually beat the CPM of Facebook and Google ads if you're looking to specifically talk to like 25 to 35 year old.
Oh, I want beat that CPM, baby.
Yeah. Wow, that is pretty impressive though. Just that, like, because I mean, I feel like if you're a publisher or if you're any kind of online entity now and you want to be able to do anything in terms of advertising, you have to be so niche and so specific. Yeah. Like with us, like we do really good, like being able to just do advertising for marijuana brands because they can't do Facebook and Google. It's like we're one of like the rare companies who seems to get that. We're not scared to take those ads. We're not scared to like try to develop stuff with them. And that's like a big thing for us. But I mean, that's a rare market that happens to be growing, and that's that isn't safe for brands or for Facebook and Google.
One thing that we do is that we can offer advertisers organic reach, right? So people just love and share hard time stuff. So like our most recent sponsored post was by Orange Amplifiers, right? Which is like a brand I grew up totally admiring.
And when you see somebody setting up an Orange amp, like, these guys got fucking money. Like, holy shit, what do you mean an Orange?
Right. But so if Orange was to go to Facebook or Google, they would have to pay for each little impression, right? Mm. But with us, we can offer them bulk organic impression because we'll write a fucking joke that also serves as an ad.
Right.
Right. You know, monetization, baby.
I'm interested in it. I don't know to what extent they're interested in it, but they should be, because this is a very interesting world to be in.
I was in a clip on your old BMX site at one point because my friend Greg tried to jump the Clipper Ledge, and I was filming it that day.
Clipper Ledge.
In San Francisco, there's the Clipper Ledge, which is about 17 stairs high, but it's a kinked ledge, and most people just skate the bottom half of it, like Mark Alpier does a bunch of shit on there. But he tried to jump it from the top and basically nosedived on his bike and bounced like a rubber ball across the pavement. Wow. And it was one of the worst slams ever, but it was posted on the come up like back in 2010.
RIP the blog era, man. That was like a very different time. It's like kind of why I'm so in awe of what you guys have created, because it just, to me, like right now I could start a fucking No Jumper blog or really hire a couple of people like write articles and stuff, but it's a tough decision because it's kind of like I don't feel like this, the world that I'm in, like is really wanting more blog posts, certainly not for like new music and stuff. It seems like that all takes place on Instagram, Twitter. It's hard for me to like imagine, and like you guys found like the perfect niche for
it's it's a brutal fucking business to get into right now. A lot of people are having a real hard time with, like, I think Noisy is being de-emphasized on Vice. Max from Rock and Roll is a little different, but Max from Rock and Roll isn't doing their print issue anymore. And
just look at all the mommy blogs aren't as popular anymore right now.
Like, probably true. Yeah, you know,
dude, so. the real truth is that we started our company with $800 and we had no real marketing plan or anything like that. We were just super lucky that people just really spread it for us. It's all organic, man. So it's like without those people, we're literally nothing. It's the only thing that keeps us above water.
If Facebook disappeared today, what would your business look like?
It would look like shit. I think 70% of our traffic comes from Facebook right now.
Right.
Yeah, that would be very bad for us.
But I just wonder how people, if Facebook disappeared, how people would consume media if that were gone.
Right,
if they would go back to just being like, I type in five websites in the morning that I check and then I go about my day.
That would be the best thing that could possibly happen to the media world, is if Facebook went away and everybody had to start, like, if somebody comes up with a really good, you know,
alternative,
a tool that's basically just going to be an RSS feed,
which
everyone has forgotten
so
about.
So if we could do well on that new platform, I think we would do even better than we're doing right now. I mean, there are literally hundreds of thousands of people who type in thehardtimes.net and go and check it out every month.
Right.
Not everyone uses Facebook. But it kind of sucks, man. We're all kind of, if I could do anything, I could go back in time and like kind of like warn publishers and be like, you're giving up way too much power to these people. You're really under their thumb nowadays. Sucks.
But it sucks so bad that it's like, I feel like there's a space available for people who want to, like, there's got to be like room for somebody to create new tools, and like maybe some of these tools already exist, but for people who want to, you know, have a nice organized way to find articles or find stuff that they want to engage with that isn't just be completely dominated by Facebook.
Do you want to hear my idea?
Yes.
I have an idea for this.
Is it an RSS feed?
Not quite. Pretty much what it is it's like an open platform with an ad share, an ad revenue share model for the content.
Why are you
creators.
Writing this down?
Well, you were tweeting about this the other day, right?
Yeah. So it's like pretty much, imagine if it was like you could post anything you want, a joke, a meme, an article. But if that article goes viral on, let's say this thing looks like Reddit. If it goes viral on Reddit, the platform counts how many views you've got. It figures out what the RPM or CPM on those ads are. And then you get, like on YouTube, it's 35%, right?
Right.
So it's like kind of like you would get a cut of all the revenue for the content that you create. Because right now we all just create content and throw it up on these big platforms for nothing.
And YouTube's the only one that you can monetize on.
Yeah. So it'd be interesting to see if maybe that could force the others to compete and to come up with similar things. Facebook did just come out with something where like they're trying to get your Facebook fans to give you $5 a month or something like that.
Right.
It's called, like, I forget what it's called.
See, YouTube just came out with that. Actually, if you head to youtube.com/nojumper and look right on the homepage, it says join. And you can click that button and you can become a member and you pay $5 a month. And you don't really get too much, but you get custom emojis that you can use in the chat and on the stream. It's something.
Let's
I got
do it,
50,
man.
50 currently. So I'm making a whopping $200 a month. But I'm feeling pretty good about it.
What we do is we
slow grind.
Yeah,
you know?
It really makes me wish I turned it on like a year ago when it came out.
I always think about that sort of stuff. Like, it's hard to predict what platform's going to work, right?
Right.
Imagine the guy who built his whole thing on Snapchat or whatever. You're like,
God,
fuck!
Right?
So the thing that we're doing that's similar to that is we're doing our Patreon. But what we do is you get to pose photos and be in Hard Times photos and tagged in them.
Wow.
Or you get your name in the article if you want. That's our little Patreon gifts that we're giving.
Well, that's pretty badass.
We started a podcast network.
Really? So you have other podcasts that you looped in now?
Yeah, and we're going to keep building it. We have one for the video game side of things called The Hard Drive. And then we have one that's coming out in about a week, a new one. And we have several more planned. A lot of the stuff that we do, we're trying to like hype up our contributors who live all over the place. So you get to meet a lot more of the people behind Hard Times.
And
that's the goal.
Are you two the only full-timers?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just went full-time within the last 2 or 3 weeks. So it's been 4 years of, you know, working in a warehouse, then going home, ignoring my wife to write satire, and she's like, "What are you doing?" Like,
right.
"I'm working, honey. Please."
How does she feel now that you? Have...
I think she hates it even more now because I'm around all the time.
Really?
she leaves to work, and I'm there, just like, "See you later." And then she comes back, and I doesn't look like I've moved all day.
Your sweatpants
like,
or whatever.
Yeah, like no, I've been doing a lot. Like, like I don't have a physical product where it's like I shipped all these things out of the house today. It's like. Do you want to see how many words I edited? You know, like,
right.
And she does not.
Hard times have been quite a grind, man. Like, so I think I had a full-time job for about 2 years. We're about 4.5 years in. I think I had a full-time job doing hard times for either a year or two. And Bill just went full-time. And we've never taken any investment from anyone. And we still own the whole thing.
And we've been able to pay our contributors and everybody from day one.
Yeah.
Where, like, I think we actually... influenced other satire sites that were of note that weren't paying their contributors, and they were just like, well, the hard times pays, and it's, I mean, you're not gonna change your life with a hard times article, but like part of the reason I was only able to go full-time now is if we weren't paying people, I would have been able to go full-time fucking 3 years ago.
It's a tough decision as a publisher because it's like you're not making much money early on, but then, and you know, it is, there's definitely an extent to which you could get people to write for free, but it's kind of unethical. It feels dirty to like try to get people to do that. If you, you're not going to get very high quality work from people. Yeah. They're always going to be looking for another opportunity.
As a fucking full-time freelance writer previously, like I just felt like I couldn't do that. There was like being real with you. There was times in our past where I pulled out my credit card and I'm like, it's time to pay these people, you know, like we didn't even have the money yet. It all worked out now though.
Yeah.
You're fucking crushing it.
Yeah,
no, that's amazing. But how do you structure that in the beginning? Like you just figure out like sort of X small amount of money that you can afford per article, or did you always have it looped into like where your, you know, the amount you get paid is connected to how well your content performs?
Yeah, we never did the performance pay thing. We did bonuses for a while where, you know, you get an extra, you get like $100 or something if you have the best article of the month. Nowadays, the only way you're really ever going to get $100 writing a hard times article, unfortunately, is if it's a sponsored content piece, which we do have a decent chunk of. So people get an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, there's at least one or two a month that people have that chance of getting. There's probably people that have made more money through the hard times than I have, like with the amount of stuff they've done.
So the thing that we were able to do is, so we weren't able to, as an independent publisher, we're not really able to pay our people that well or make any sort of dent in that thing. But what we were able to do is we were able to take our magazine and use it as a place to test this new thing and a product to launch. We created this thing called Outvoice, and it's pretty much, I was a full-time freelance writer, right? So I would write,
so you know how horrible it can be.
Horrible, right? I would write for these major publications, Rolling Stone or whoever, and I get the paycheck like fucking 2 months later,
right,
or whatever, right? And so at hard times, we created our own little solution where as soon as Bill hits publish on your joke, you're sent an email that it's live, a link to it, and your payment immediately. And it's all digitally. Done. So,
and this is the kind of thing that I kept seeing the same reaction on Twitter, where this sounds like something that BuzzFeed should have invented a while back, but then instead, like, it's not really advantageous for them to invent something like this because they profit from the ability to sort of give people the runaround. If you write something and then you don't follow up enough times, then they just never even pay you. Freelancers have all dealt with this.
It's really interesting because that's kind of how I felt about it too. But when I really started to dig into it, there's a lot of advantages for publishers to pay on time. And so one of the main things is that we're cutting a huge amount of time out of the whole process. So we're not just helping you pay your people quicker. We're helping you not pay an accountant to spend, you know, 30 hours at the end of the month. Dude, when I worked at SF Weekly, they had me print out each individual invoice. It took me a full day out of my month, and I had to sign them all. And then I'll never forget the editor-in-chief of the whole paper comes out, and he's got this weird wooden contraption, right? It's got all these like little like flaps to it, and he's like, you had to put all your invoices in here, and it was like an alphabetizing thing. So it was like A, last name B, last name C. And I remember thinking, dude, we're in San Francisco, like the most high-tech place in the world, and you're having me alphabetize these printed out pieces of paper with a weird wooden contraption. So like, that's not advantageous for a publisher to pay me a full-time salary to use this wooden contraption. So it is something where the math is a little bit complicated, but it gives you a competitive advantage because freelancers want to pitch you more, and it also helps you save a lot of time, which does save you money.
Right, so, yeah. And it feels like the kind of thing where probably you guys are going to be able to bring other publishers on and be able to like connect them with this technology. Yeah. Is that the idea?
Yeah, we've already we're doing a little beta test, and I think we have about 7 signed up right now. Our biggest one is Fanbyte Media, which is actually a media company that owns several different publications, and they're much larger than Hard Times. So right. I think we are having an impact. We're pushing the industry in the right direction, I think, and that's exciting.
And everybody kept having the same reaction too. Is like, I cannot believe this is coming from the dudes who write the funny hardcore titles. Like, how the fuck did these guys figure out this problem for all the freelancers the world that all these other motherfuckers have no clue?
I think Matt was spending too much of his time at the end of each month doing so much with the invoicing that it was just like, how can I get this time back? And then that's where he came up with that. And I've just been telling him, I think it's a bad idea, Matt.
You know? So you were kind of against it at first.
Oh, no, I don't think I've had an opinion to his face.
Right. He helps me out with it, though. He tells me what's wrong with it, and we help tweak it.
I've been the guinea pig for the most of the, like, you know, if I'm the company person that has been signed up, like, what would I be telling Matt is wrong with it? Like, that's how I've tried to be as honest as possible. Like, this doesn't work. This should be better.
So the real...
He hates me a little bit.
The real thing is that I was a full-time freelancer who dealt with this, and then I was a full-time editor who dealt with this, and then I was a full-time publisher who dealt with it.
Wow. Okay.
And
so I
saw all the different problems with it, and a lot of people don't understand because they haven't experienced it, is it actually really is a pain in the ass for the publisher side of things. Like, this makes my life as a publisher way, way easier.
But it's a very rare situation that the publisher is actually the person who's involved with the nitty-gritty of getting all the freelancers paid. Normally, the person who owns it doesn't really have too much of an incentive.
It's interesting, though, because it is a problem that scales to the size of the organization, because we're in talks right now with a very large publication that is like a household name. I'll tell you about them right after we get off this thing. And they see this as a huge problem that they want to solve with Outvoice, right? So it's a problem where if you're an independent publisher, you might have this. But at the same time, if you have 5 bureaus across the U.S. and Canada and, you know, 10,000 freelancers, you might also have this problem.
It's a really interesting time because, like, at the same time that we're hearing so much about how it's impossible to make a living in the publishing world, you're seeing all these massive, like, all the success stories from a few years ago, Vice and BuzzFeed, they all seem like they're taking big hits. But then, meanwhile, it's like... you're seeing a lot of the union stuff popping up where people are trying to unionize and everything. Every day I'm seeing the Pitchfork Union Twitter tweeting at Condé Nast trying to get recognized. It's a really fascinating thing to watch unfold.
I think they said that was the longest it's ever been for a publisher to recognize a union is Pitchfork.
Me watching this is slowly turning into this sort of like sadistic thing where I'm like, how much longer is this going to take? This is crazy.
I watch all that stuff too, like the Vice Union and like the Onion started a union. Dude, honestly, I don't know I'm like not educated enough to know how much they help. I do know that when the Onion laid off a bunch of people, the union helped get them all like a nice package to go out the door. And they got it was way better than if they didn't have a union.
Right.
Matt's great-grandfather was a big union buster back in the early days. So he was the guy driving those cow catchers into the protesting.
He's got a different agenda here.
I'm definitely pro union. The only thing is, I think sometimes it's blood from a stone, right? Like, if the publisher is fucking dying anyways.
I mean, that's how you got to feel about the Pitchfork thing, is that it's like, it seems like a really great thing if this works out. But at the same time, how much fucking money is Pitchfork making to the extent that Condé Nast is going to give a shit about acknowledging this?
I don't know. Didn't Pitchfork, they just decided to do a paywall thing, right?
Well, that's the other thing, is that that's all coming soon at some point. Yeah.
I mean, as a consumer of online media, like, paywall, I'm like, I'm out instantly. Like, I don't care how good your content was on Pitchfork. No, I haven't read a Pitchfork.
You
want to
pay for Pitchfork? No, I guess I wouldn't either.
Yeah. Not a chance.
I think they've got some really high quality stuff. I think I would pay.
They do, but I just don't know that I would pay. Like, I definitely don't feel the sort of fondness for it. I pay for the New York Times. Yeah. It doesn't give me that feeling.
I pay for New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal, I think.
I get finessed out of the New York Times twice because I pay for the fucking crossword puzzle that I haven't done in 6 months, too. I went on vacation and I just started doing the crossword puzzles and paid fucking $60, and then I haven't touched it in 6 months.
Yeah, you're the one guy that's keeping it alive right now. They're like, we still got him.
I would have never imagined you as the guy who's paying for the New York Times crossword puzzle.
And not that good at it either. Like, really trying my heart out and not doing that great.
Yeah, dude, I don't know. The paywall stuff is really interesting. The unfortunate part, like, the Onion's having huge problems too, right?
Really?
But no one's really paying paywall for comedy. That's not really a thing that's worked out in the past.
The Onion has tried to do the paywall thing?
They've considered it. They haven't done it.
Don't think that would work.
They're having economic problems, right? They've been sold a couple times, and I think their value keeps decreasing. It's a rough time out there for publishers. We're kind of in this weird lucky. We're a little bit lucky that we are like a DIY organization with a lot of passion,
right?
And then we've
never at one point be like, we need an office. Like, no, we don't need an office. Like, you know, like we just continue to work out of our bedrooms.
I had to convince this guy not to sleep in his car. We're going to Vegas. We're going to Vegas for a festival, right? We're gonna have a tent. We're doing a comedy night, right? And I literally had to tell
it's
him, you're gonna
damage.
Die.
It's
that's
punk
the most
damage.
Punk thing I ever heard in my life,
Bill. It's the desert, dude. You can't sleep in your car.
It cools down at night.
You're going to get beat up by a fucking meth head in your sleep.
I talked him into an Airbnb.
It'll be like in Dirty Work where the guy smashes the back of the window open. Like, hey, buddy, trying to sleep back here.
I was on tour once. I tried to sleep in my car in Tucson, Arizona during a historic heat wave. And I literally almost died. I woke up and I was like...
Did you put the windows down?
I put the windows down and a bag of ice on my forehead and a bag of ice on my chest.
Holy shit.
What was happening was inside, this guy had, no exaggeration, 25, 30 stray dogs in his house. This is where we were sleeping.
Oh my God.
I laid down to try to go to sleep, and this blind dog gets on top of me and starts humping me, right? And so I pushed this dog off, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, right? I'm like tired. He's like, I just want to go to sleep, man. There's like thick dirt on the floor. There's vats all over his living room. Looks like he's cooking meth. I found out later, I think it was wine.
Wow, but, that sounds horrible.
So I go to lay down again, and the blind dog gets back on top of me, and then another dog gets on top of it and starts fucking the blind dog, right, on top of me. And at that point, I was like, I don't care if I die. I'm
bestiality
sleeping.
Bestiality orgy. You just found
I'm
yourself
sleeping in the van, dude. No more stray dog threesomes for me.
That sounds so brutal. Oh my God, that's grimy as fuck. No, I have so many memories like that of like being, you know, sleeping on couches on tour and stuff and just having these horrible situations come up. And when I think about like the level of comfort that I'm used to now as an adult who lives in Hollywood, it's like, holy shit, like that really, really seems like something that I'm probably never going to be able to do again.
Even like when I've done like comedy things, like let's stay with some friends in Seattle or something, and I go and like sleep on their couch and like I pull the blanket up to my face and the blanket smells like shit. Like, we're like the same age, man. Like, do you not like, what the fuck? Like, if you came to my house, you'd be super comfortable, you know? Right, like, what the hell is this?
Oh, man, your wife is like, makes your house beautiful. I'm not buying that it's, you're in charge of making everything perfect.
I'm full-time at the house now. You think I'm like in an apron sweeping and doing stuff like around the house.
His wife has like beautiful plants all over the place.
When
gorgeous
I'm watering them at this point at certain times of the day.
I never had a level of appreciation for a clean house like I do now that I live with a girl who is used to having a clean house. And now we have like cleaning lady and everything like that. So I don't really have to think about it. But now I don't feel like I could go back to being like a disgusting pig who doesn't have the floor swept or cleaned for like 2 months straight.
I do feel like doing those DIY tours has allowed me to do a lot of cool stuff. Like I went backpacking in Japan and I slept in like random hostels. And a hostel to me, it feels like I'm in paradise.
Right. Yeah,
it's like a, I'm like, wow,
four
like
stars.
Presidential suite. This is fucking sick. I get my own bunk.
Right.
Yeah, this is great.
A couple from Finland is fucking above you, but who cares?
I used to always take a lot of pride in being able to sleep on the floor anywhere I could go, or like, you know, I'd be on a trip and I would let the riders, the BMX pros, like sleep on the couch and everything. I would sleep on the ground. I'd be the hardcore team manager that's gonna like take care of them. My body just is not going to deal with sleeping on the ground the same way that it would have a while back.
I think we're cut from the same cloth there, where I'm always like the same person. Like, you take the bed, I got the floor, you know? Right. Well, there's room for two of us. Like, you just take the bed.
I wanted to be that person so bad. And it's like, as time has gone by, I'm just realizing that I'm no longer that person.
Well, dude, the floor will fuck you up. That's one thing I learned on tour is I got like a little bedroll. A bedroll will save you on tour.
Oh, yes. That was a good point.
I kept always going on tour during the summer. Right, and then it's just fucking unbearable. People ask me what I think about different places. I go, oh, it's too hot. Like, you're talking about New York? I'm like, yeah, it's 120. Like, you're just there at the wrong time. What are you talking
about?
But
I have like memories in my head of like hanging out with like hardcore girl. Like, I was hanging out with this hardcore girl who would just let bands stay at her house. And I remember a couple different times I would be like chilling in her room. All of a sudden, it would be this straight edge band that would pull up and they would all just lay out their sleeping bags and just go to sleep on the floor. And I would just be like, what the fuck is wrong with these dudes? Like, this is such a weird way of life. And I'm looking at the girl like, you're even weirder for allowing this.
Yeah, dude, there's a lot of people who let you sleep at their place. They're great people. You can't do it without them. One time I slept at this place where okay, we were playing, I think this is in Salt Lake, and we're playing and I see this dude in the pit, and it's a concrete floor, and he is drunk and he falls and really cracks his head.
Wow.
Like, they dragged him out of the place. Like, he was fucked up. And one thing leads to another, the show's over, and we're like, does anyone have a place to stay? And they're like, yeah, man, come to our place. We're going to be partying a bit, but like you guys can sleep there, no big deal. And so like we're in the same room. It's like the size of this room. And we're in sleeping bags trying to sleep while the dude who cracked his head, it turns out to be his house, uh-huh. and it's his party. And they are just shit-faced, yelling in the same room as us to the point where something happens and they start having a fight with steel chairs against each other.
And you're on the ground pretending to be thinking about how you don't drink. Like, what the fuck is wrong with these people?
Yeah, I was the weirdo straight-edge kid on the floor. And these guys are cracking these steel chairs against each other. And we just like stood up. Like, we gotta get a fucking hotel, man. That's it. We can't do it.
Hotel is such a last resort when you're on tour. It feels like the biggest cop-out.
Yeah.
That's worse than Breaking Edge.
Do you remember that band Ion Dissonance by any chance? Or like a tech metal band from Canada? Okay. They played like a show in Worcester one time, and they're like, after the show, they're like, we need a place to stay. And my brother was, I was still living at home with my mom, so we had three bedrooms, you know, and my brother was gone for the weekend. I was like, oh, they can stay in my brother's room. But my mother was a bartender, came home at like 2 a.m. to a bunch of Canadians drinking like Michelob Light in her kitchen. And she's like, oh, my grandparents are French Canadian, is trying to speak French with them. And like, it was a good time. But none of them spoke any English. One of them was super allergic to cats and had to sleep out in the van in the middle of Massachusetts winter.
Oh my God.
There's a Hard Times headline that's something like, I love the picture from it. And it's something like, girlfriend thrilled that eight of your friends are sleeping on every surface of apartment tonight. Yeah. And there's like a guy in the picture, like sleeping on top of the refrigerator and shit. I also think there's another one that I particularly liked that was something like, band creates like crack team of investigators to figure out how host's shower works.
Yeah, those were my friends in that photo. That was taken at
the photos. That's always gonna be a tricky decision sometimes, because there's either like creative Photoshop being done, or like sometimes it'll be like a story about so and so does this, and it's like clear that you had to find a photo of somebody and that is not the person who's doing that thing.
It's honestly the hardest part. Like really? The Onion and a lot of those other people, they have like an art department. We have a Chris from the band Mindset. He plays in a band called No Heads now, and he's like a photographer guy, and he just helps us out with a lot of it. We've got some people who are contributors, will post pictures, and it's actually kind of like it's the hardest part, one of the bottlenecks for our whole thing probably.
Yeah, really? So many of the times it's like the character is a scumbag character, so like
asking, who would want to be labeled as that? It's like, again, the herpes model for like the billboard, you know, for like the herpes cream.
Yeah, so like a couple of times, like I'll ask text friends, like, would you want to pose this? And like, what's the headline? And I'll give it to him, like, yeah, maybe the next one. Like, yeah, I get it. But I think we've put ourselves in like shitty guy articles before.
I'm in like dozens of shitty guy articles. I'm in one that's like straight edge guy. Inadvertently following don't fuck rule. It's like me on my bed with like this goofy, like overly straight edge jersey some friend gave me.
I was thinking about that last night when I was thinking about interviewing you guys, and just thinking about how all of my years that I spent straight edge, mm-hmm. I really had almost no access to drugs or alcohol, and I just don't deserve any points for being able to avoid drinking when I was 14. You know, I was straight edge till I was like 21.
Dude,
but
hold on, you broke edge at 21? That's the first time I've heard of this.
For real? No.
You got That's me. Like the old joke. Dude, wait, really? I think it was kind of harder being straight edge when I was 14 or 15. I think that was one of the main things that's held me back from like in the straight edge world, where like I was like, oh, this kind of sucks. There's this girl I really liked in middle school, and she was like, come after school and drink with me under the bridge or something like that. And
I never really had that problem. Like, to me, all the cool like dudes who would like fit into the category that I considered myself at that time, like most of my like role models, even just within my social circle, were like tough guy, fucking straight edge dudes.
Really?
So it was like very easy for me to like make that decision.
All my skateboard friends, like, we'd go into Boston, you know, take the red line into Boston, and then the first stop would be like, we got to go to the Rastas in the park because we're going to buy weed. And so then I'd just like kind of sit and watch them buy weed. And there was one time where they bought weed from a dude in the back alley who robbed them. And I was like sitting on the curb, like around the block.
Best feeling when you realize, like, haha, I got to miss out on your misfortune because I don't do that.
They blamed me for it. They're like, if you were there, we would have been able to stop. It's like, there's two of you.
Did he have a weapon?
No, he picked up a 2x4 and then like brandished it.
Come on.
What you gonna do with that?
Just get in tight and you can't swing that thing. And but yeah, they blamed me. But yeah, my skateboard friends were all like stoners, and then they got progressively worse as time went on and moved on to other drugs, and I just kind of faded away from them. But
in my local area, I'm actually like the kids who I grew up in the scene, like going to shows with, I think I'm pretty much the last straight edge guy. Like, we were all straight edge at one point, mm-hmm. and now I'm like the weirdo.
I think I'm the last one out of my main crew of friends, other than my brother. We're the only north of 30 straight edge guys.
Does it feel weird being straight edge at this point when it seems like such a huge percentage of the people that maybe you were influenced by early on or whatever have fallen off? I'm guessing that at a certain point with you guys, it's just that's who you are. It's not some
decision. I've talked about it a lot where I think there's a certain percentage of people that want to get fucked up by everything. There's more people in the middle, and then there's the polar opposite of the don't want to get fucked up at all. I just find myself in the I don't want to do anything, you know, and then straight edge happens to be a thing. So.
I don't know. Like, I feel like it's weird. I feel like straight edge was a term that really fit me more than I fit the term. Like, my general interests are not really, I'm not like a let's kick back and, you know, get high and watch like a nature movie. I feel like that's what people do when they smoke weed. Is that what they do?
We should do that, guys, thing. Later. I want to watch some nature movies.
I'm more of like, I want to work 80 hours a week. I want to build things. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds kind of corny, but, and you can do both, and a lot of people do, mm-hmm. but it's just never really interests me. And then a lot of the social things, I think a lot of people break edge because there's some social things that are holding them back. Those things never quite held me back. Mm. You know what I mean? Like that one girl in middle school, I think, didn't like me because I didn't want to drink. You know,
and then
I mean?
She died. So,
but after that, not as much. So I've been pretty like fortunate that my friends pretty much accept me.
I remember one time I was with a bunch of BMX dudes. Like I was the team manager on this tour that we were doing, and we go to Hooters. And
what team did you manage, by the way?
I mean, just my website, okay. On some shit BMX team or whatever. But like, you know, I'm maybe at this point I'm like 27, but I got all these dudes who ride for me that are mostly like 21 or like 19 or whatever. We go to the Hooters. This super hot waitress gets my number, and I'm feeling myself. And then she decides like she wants to meet up with all of us, and I'm like involuntarily straight edge this night because I had to drive the van. Mm-hmm. And then she ends up basically like, because I'm not trying to drink with her, she ends up going with like my fucking Australian friend, and like literally like she's sleeping with him in like the Airbnb in this room, and I'm seeing her like naked, like scampering past the door to the bathroom. And I was like, in that moment, I was just like, you know, this just feels so fucked up. And like, I drink, like I could have drank. I just had to drive.
Yeah, dude. One time.
Well, you're not going to convince the Australian not to drink.
No. And the 19-year-old hot Australian kid is like, I mean, she picked her poison. And I understand.
Dude. So I made a mistake like that one. It wasn't so much straight edge. It was just that I'm a kind of an idiot. I was like being super oblivious. I was reporting on the Dew Tour. Which like a skateboard.
Sick tour, by the way. I mean, legendary.
I hosted it for like NBC one year or some shit. Like I did some like on camera stuff.
Yeah, dude, it was fucking awesome being there. And I was a reporter on the college paper, and I was interviewing a bunch of the skaters and just hanging out. And so I was in the backstage area, and it's winding down. The whole thing's winding down, come to a close. And the host of the event, she's like a host/PR person, and she's just gorgeous. And she comes up to me and she goes like, oh yeah, like I'm only in San Francisco for one night. Like it's like, where like should I eat around here? And I was like, I don't know, just find somewhere. Yeah,
house
and
of then, man can't go.
And then she was like, no, but like you're from here, right? I'm like, yeah. And she's like, well, like where would you go? Or like what's going on after the event? And like, she's really like, and I'm like, I don't know. Like I got to go home. Like I have homework or whatever. And like, I'm just like totally brushing her off for some reason. And then she leaves, and the photographer who was working with me as a reporter was like, dude, what the fuck is wrong with you? And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, that girl wanted to go get food with you, and you'd like told her to fuck off. And I didn't even realize. I thought she was just asking me for like Yelp information. I think I literally told her like, look at Yelp.
Right. Like, you're so like blinded to the idea that she could be flirting with you.
Yeah. And she was like a, I don't know what it's called. Like, what's it called when you're like Miss Nebraska? She was like Miss Nebraska.
Beauty queen?
Yeah. She,
whoever it is, I'm pretty sure I met her because I remember the Dew Tour. I remember that there would be like hot girls, like kind of in charge of, or like they were doing like hosting duties, stuff like that.
There was one that was like a, like Miss Nebraska or Miss Ohio or something like that.
Sounds kind of familiar. Yeah. I don't know.
You remember eating dinner with her one night? No, yeah.
After he turned her down.
Sorry, this there. Fucking tattooed up guy. It's fucking bummer, man.
Man, let me tell you about this guy who doesn't drink that I just tried to take on a date. Oh, man. So in terms of future plans and stuff that you guys have on the way, what seems most evident or like things that really seem, or maybe even in like the long term, like what do you guys hope to accomplish with this whole thing?
Yeah, so we got a book coming out at the end of the year.
Once I hold that, I'm probably going to cry because of all like the work that's been put into it. Like,
really? He cries a lot.
Yeah. I'm, you know, I'm vegan now, so I got a lot of estrogen in my diet.
Soy boys.
Yeah, you know, you've heard of them.
Yeah, so
I love that term, dude.
So you should just title the podcast Interview with Two Soy Boys. So we're doing the book. I'm really excited about that. We just launched our podcast network. I'm really excited about that. We are going to be... We're trying to expand out into some video stuff, and that's been going, you know, touch or go, but we're eager to get going into that. And I think what you'll see from us is now that we have our full-time editor for the very first time, I think that you'll see a lot more from us. I think you'll see more coverage, and we'll see what the future holds for where we grow from there.
How many articles on average do you guys publish in a day?
Across all platforms, 6 or 7.
Yeah, probably 6 or 7.
Do you guys ever think about pivoting to video?
Yeah, man. I mean, we've thought about it.
As they say.
I think it's a little bit my weak point. Like, it's not my skill set. Mm-hmm. So, like, I was, like, a writer. And so I think I understand the economics of that. And mm-hmm. I understand now how to make money from that. You know, right. Like, we have a system that, like, is profitable, right? We don't have investors. So we always have to, like, turn a little bit of a profit. And with video, I just often find... We shoot videos. We got some really funny ones by Ryan Long and a whole bunch of other people. Mm-hmm. And we're doing some more. We're doing this cool thing for Hard Drive. It's a whole new video series that we're going to be putting up weekly. It's coming out pretty soon. But I can never really find out how to make like money off of it.
Well, we kind of got fucked over with the Facebook video thing when that first
came
out.
We made a mistake. We thought we're gonna like fuck YouTube. We're gonna keep building on Facebook because we already have all of our people there. And they were saying that there was gonna be like a similar monetization tool that is YouTube.
Did they ever at any point hand over a check to you guys? I heard that they were paying a bunch of publishers to make video, and people kept acting like, "Oh, you should do this." I'm like, I've been on the special list of people who get invited to do this.
We never get on the special list. Yeah. The special list is like New York Times, right? And then there's like a couple like the Chive or something. Right. Like, I don't know.
I mean, I think that if you guys are going to go real hard with the podcasting thing, that okay, like there's your YouTube presence to start. But I would be kind of interested to see how exactly you could translate the satire vibe into YouTube. That would be interesting.
So like we can do general comedy videos, you know what I mean? But to actually do the satire is like, it's kind of like, it takes like kind of a lot of time to write it. Mm-hmm. And then like to shoot it is like not very cheap. We're trying to figure it out.
I actually haven't really spent any time looking at what The Onion does on YouTube. I should probably look into that. It might be interesting.
So The Onion had a TV show where they had like a news desk, right?
Right, yeah.
And they had some videos from that. And then ClickHoles found a pretty good thing where they shoot for pretty cheap, which is like a black screen and then just characters, you know, reading a script of whatever they're kind of like a BuzzFeedy, you know,
yeah.
10 times I... You know, whatever.
That, I love that BuzzFeed has like created their YouTube presence off of just like finding people to tell them stories on camera. It's just so weird that worked.
So like, yeah, I don't know. I'm sure that's in our future, but I think it's a personal, like I don't truly have that skill set. So I think I kind of avoid it a little bit.
I would love to see you guys' take on like when I look at the new crop of YouTube channels to me is like when you see like the GQ YouTube, the mm-hmm. Vogue YouTube, and they're just doing this like, you know, so-and-so reacts to the worst tattoos she's ever seen. And mm-hmm. it's just strange to me. It's like, since when are you guys as a media company, did you decide that this is who you were?
Yeah.
But it just seems so stupid that I would love to see it spoofed by you guys. But then again, I don't know exactly.
So that's the thing, right? So that's the thing, right? Do you satirize the format because you're going to that new format, or do you keep satirizing the things that your audience likes, right? So do we? So like our biggest video ever was Art of Grumpy. It's about an angry sound guy, right? And Ryan Long just did a terrific job with it, and you know, millions of views, right? And people really enjoy it. But it's expensive. I think we shot it on an Alexa, which is like $100,000 camera or whatever, you know right. what I mean? And
which he like borrowed from the Canadian government or something like that.
His friend was like shooting a music video or something, and like they shot this thing like in between takes. I don't know. But we paid the guy something or whatever. Whatever, even if it's not expensive, it's always like $2,000, I feel like.
Not very expensive.
You know what I mean?
I mean, if I had to spend $2,000 for every podcast that I did, then I would be turning a profit on like 5% of the podcast that
right.
I do.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I hope we're able to figure out something unique to do with it. We've had some ideas. We've been kicking around some stuff. Hopefully, I think that's in our future.
It's just nice to see a media company that, because you guys are self-contained, that you're able to grow at a rate that you actually feel comfortable with. Whereas we've seen so many like decent media companies sort of just drown in the desire to progress and get bigger. Oh,
dude, so I'll drop this on your podcast. Exclusive. We haven't announced it yet.
Oh, shit. I don't even know if I've heard this.
Talk about our future plans. We're doing a real music and culture section.
Yeah. Oh.
So that's coming out soon.
That's dope.
Yeah. That's actually where my background is.
But right? Still satire?
No, not satire. So like a non-satirical. You know how The Onion has the AV club?
Yeah.
We're going to like create our own AV club.
Wow.
Kind of like a noisy thing.
Wow. That sounds great.
Yeah. And so I wrote for Noisy and Rolling Stone and SF Weekly and Vice and all those places. So that's actually where I got started. So I'm really eager to get the opportunity to do it.
Oh, wow. Bring it right back to reality.
Yeah.
There you go. That sounds awesome. Well, I really appreciate you guys coming in. It's really super interesting. You know, I'm a fan of like the actual content that you guys have been doing and then what it seems like you guys are building for the future of online journalism. It's really, really exciting. So I appreciate you guys coming in.
Thanks for having us, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no doubt. And to anybody who wants to check their stuff out.
Hardtimes.net.
Yeah, if you can't figure it out, you're stupid. This is an hour and 20 minutes in. You should have been able to figure it out. All right. I appreciate you
Someone's
guys.
Like, who am I watching?
Yeah, at a certain point, that there's probably somebody who was pretty deep and couldn't figure
These
it out.
These are the guys from The Onion? What the fuck?
All right. YouTube.com/NoJumper. Appreciate everybody doing the membership thing. It's very, very exciting for me. I know it's not a huge amount of money, but it's just like, whoa. People are actually subscribed. That's the first time I've been able to feel like that.
Yeah.
All right. Appreciate you guys. No Jumper, coolest podcast in the world. Check us out YouTube, SoundCloud, iTunes.
Wow. Thanks for having us, man.
Appreciate you.